Biofilms are these sort of a collection of sometimes a single bacteria, what are called homogeneous or heterogeneous biofilms, which are kind of a mixture of bacteria that live together, sometimes nicely, sometimes not. So these biofilms are formed over a certain long time. You know, you can't produce a biofilm in 24 hours. You essentially, they produce this exopolysaccharide, which is like a glue. And this glue sticks the cells onto the surface and it matures over time and it gives long persistence.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Bob Odker. Today I have Dr. Keith Warner with me, and I'm going to ask him to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about himself.
Oh, thanks there, Bob. So I'm a food microbiologist at the University of Guelph in Canada. I've been here, must be about 24, 25 years. I keep losing count. So essentially our sort of research is to do with food safety. And part of that food safety is decontaminating fresh produce, meat, and other low moisture foods, but also obviously sanitation environment. So our research is focused on that area, you know, producing novel technologies, doing risk assessment. We do consultancy as well when we're trying to troubleshoot people's spoilage problems and things like that. And they also teach on the food micro, industrial micro, food safety management and principles of food science. So it's quite a big one. So through all the experiences I've had with industry and things like that, it's interesting when we can get our research and apply it to a real problem. So yeah, in a nutshell, that's my background.
Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
That's very interesting. I'm a feed guy myself, but I do a bunch of barbecuing. So food safety, I'm pretty concerned about that as well. So I'm always eager to learn about that. And I got to confess, I don't know much about biofilms. So I'm looking forward to what you can tell us about, what are biofilms and how do they differ from traditional biofilms?
All right. So biofilms, if you're in the industry, you definitely know biofilms a lot. Not so much in the low moisture industry, but I'll come to those dry biofilms later. So any sort of facility, especially producing dairy products, high protein, ultimately develop biofilms. And biofilms are these sort of a collection of sometimes a single bacteria, what are called homogeneous or heterogeneous biofilms, which are kind of a mixture of bacteria that live together, sometimes nicely, sometimes not. So these biofilms are formed over a certain long time. You know, you can't produce a biofilm in 24 hours. You essentially, they produce this exopolysaccharide, which is like a glue. And this glue sticks the cells onto the surface and it matures over time. And it gives long persistence. So, for example, for Listeria monocytogenes, this facility was recovering the same Listeria for 12 years in a row. They did everything, all the sanitizers you could think of, all the procedures. They couldn't get rid of these biofilms. And it's a classic example where you use collection of bacteria not only enhance the survival of Listeria by cross-feeding, but also the physical structure of the biofilm provides protection against desiccation, sanitizers and things like that. And once you have biofilms, they're really hard to get rid of. You know, I could give you a story, a quite local one, where a local university, not University of Guelph, down the road was a university who had coliforms in the piping. and they tried everything. And the only thing they could do to remove a biofilm was literally to replace the pipework. So biofilms are a big problem because they constantly introduce contamination, be it foodborne illness pathogens or spoilage microbes. And the frustrating thing about them is that you think you've got them beat, you get negative results by testing, but then they come back again. So that's the traditional wet biofilm, takes a long time, you know, moisture and things like that. But the new sort of area on the block, so to speak, it's been around 10 years now, are the dry biofilms. And this takes everything up a notch. And when we say take up a notch, dry biofilms essentially are much more resistant to heat, much more resistant to sanitizers, and they persist for a long time. Now, the difference between a dry biofilm and a wet biofilm, as the name suggests, is that these dry biofilms develop in low moisture environments, like feed mills, things like this. And they were first discovered, first noticed, I suppose, back in 2012. And there was a, this was in the clinical hospital settings. And, you know, essentially what was happening, they were sanitizing these sort of wards and cubicles. And they could never get rid of MRSA. You know, they got everything there, you know, sanitizers and everything like that. Then somebody started looking more closely at the surface. And what they found was, when we do our sanitation in hospitals, it's not so good, to be honest. But the reality is they've got strong sanitizer, but they recovered these bacteria after sanitizing the area. And they looked on things like curtains that could find the bacteria again. And we're wondering, how could these bacteria survive the sanitizers that they're using? So what they did is start looking closely at them. And what they found is this sort of very thin monolayer of cells, not like a biofilm, which is this sort of glutinous structure, but these dry biofilms essentially are very dispersed, they're very thin. And the thing is that when they tried to do swabbing of them, you know, the swab to culture, they couldn't find anything. It wasn't registering. They even tried this ATP meter. So ATP meters used in the industry as a sort of rough assessment of living microbes on the surface. All living microbes have ATP. It didn't register. No ATP was detected. So I think they naturally assumed, saying, well, these bacteria just dried on. And not only just dried on, but they're dead as well. But then as the sort of area developed, what we're finding is that, no, these bacteria weren't dead at all. They were basically hibernating in this what we call a viable but non-culturable state. So without going off too many tangents, the viable but non-culturable state is, as the name suggests, the viable but the non-culturable. So you can't just culture them on media. And the dormant state is essentially bacteria's way of hibernating. And, you know, it's a long history about VBNC, but essentially it's this sort of intermediate between life and death, so to speak, where you're just hibernating, just hunkering down. Now, the thing with dormancy is that it got people started to look at dormancy because people always say, well, VBNC is just a decline of cell viability. They're not going to do anything. They're just going to die and things like this. But when techniques came along, viability staining, obviously PCR and pieces like that, lo and behold, these bacteria are actually alive on the surface and they could exist for weeks and weeks, and if not months. And when they started to say, well, are they infectious? Yes, they are infectious. They could, and they used a white moth larva model as that. So with dry biofilms, you've got this nightmare scenario where you've got these biofilms on the surface. Now, whether they're kind of put on that surface by physiological means or just accidentally, but they survive and they can start contaminating whatever product goes over them. And you can't detect them using simple techniques like swabbing or ATPing. What we do know, for instance, we can recover them if we have special agents in the actual growth media to break them out of this dormancy. Things like pyruvate, catalase, all help to revive them. So dry biofilms, in short, so this sort of nightmare scenario where you've got contamination there, but you can't detect it, and they're super resistant. You know, they can withstand 20,000 ppm bleach and things like that. So they're a bit of a headache.
Yeah, I was just sitting there wondering, to help me understand between dry and wet, you know, I deal with things like bean meal and DDGs and things, right, that are, you know, under 16% moisture. Just, is there kind of a line of, you know, what is a dry surface and what's a, you know what I mean, what's a wet surface?
I know, that's a good question, because you would say, well, you know, it's dry, it's adding moisture to it. So what they found is that even the humidity in the air is enough to support this biofilm formation, because they do think it's not just passive drying cells onto a surface. They actually think it's a physiological response where they produce a glue rather than this glutamous mass they actually can stick on. So high humidity, but the biggest risk factor is to do with wet sanitation. So in dry feed mills, obviously, you try to avoid water, but I think people get tempted saying, all right, let's do a sort of deep clean and let's use water in that sort of sanitation. And that's where the problems come, because there's a sort of thought pattern, which I believe is that wet sanitation is the worst thing to do in dry feed mills and low moisture environments. And the reason for that is because, one, it's not really sanitary design. You know, these machines and units and conveyors were built for a function, not to say, well, I can be easily cleaned. And when you get poor sanitary design, you get basically organic matter trapped, you get moisture trapped, it can't dry out. And that brief contact with water is all you need to get these biofilms active. And then and once it dries out, they can just sit there waiting for the product to come along. And the big problem with them is that, well, you say, well, even if they're getting the product, they're still going to be fairly dormant, because it's not going to be high moisture, it's still going to be about 16%. But it's when you start getting positive hits for salmonella, positive hits for like Cronobacter, and even spoilage microbes, if the food gets rehydrated, that's where the problems come. But in the feed industry, it's definitely salmonella, which is a big risk factor.
And are these biofilms, are they all, can they be viral, or are they all bacterial?
So what they've found so far, it's an emerging area, is that they're not restricted, but it's being found in quite a range of bacteria. But those bacteria that are very resistant to low moisture, Salmonella, Cronobacter, Archibacter, MRSA, you know, Staphylococcus aureus, methicillin resistant. But I think it's going to be like biofilms in general. You know, I think every bacteria produces biofilms. Now, viral contamination is different, yeah, because viruses will just sit on the surface and literally just die off. It's they're not really used to that sort of thing. But it's an interesting area in that it's only really been found in five bacteria, but it hasn't been looked at in, obviously, a vast majority of them.
Okay. Appreciate that. So I guess the next question, obvious question to me is, you know, how do we detect these biofilms?
And that is really hard part. You know, basically with a biofilm, you've got so many cells there, you can just get a swab. Yeah, some of them will be dormant, but most you could actually recover. You know, that's why you get positive samples, isn't it? So the problem with dry biofilms is that they're such in a dormant state, they're so hyminating, you have to try and wake them up. Now, there are techniques where you don't need to wake them up. You can literally stain them with these viability stains. So these viability stains are usually two types of stain. One stain can freely diffuse into the cell and make it green. But then you have another sort of dye which only can penetrate dead membranes, i.e. when there's no charge there. And that's the red dye. So basically all you do, you rack to your sample with these dyes and you look under the fluorescent microscope and say, yep, red is dead, green is alive. So that's one way. So you would expect them to be dead, but if they glow green, obviously that means we're alive. Now, the other way of doing it is what we call quantitative PCR. But because you amplify anything with PCR, you essentially have to have another dye called PMA, which would basically diffuse through a dead cell, bind to the DNA, you get no response. Now, the problem with those two techniques is that it don't work, as in you could have VBNC there that can be cultured, but the test said, no, they're dead. So the point is that to only truly know if a VBNC cell, i.e. these dry biofilms, are alive, is literally to culture them. So you're trying to culture the unculturable, But you can do this by additional things like pyruvate in the media, catalase, and even small amount of lysozyme, which basically kicks the cell off. So they are very difficult to study, and you can't use, say, swab samples. You have to be very aggressive in getting them from the surface, and you can't really use ATP meters, which are the mainstay of sanitation industry.
Well, that all makes sense. So we'll move on to other strategies then. I guess, you know, in the feed industry, we use the word mitigation quite a bit as it applies to medications and that type of thing. So are there mitigation strategies to help us with this?
Well, the only way to mitigate them is not to add water, which is a bit hard because you're trying to do wet sanitation. And you say, well, at least I need water, isn't it? They're very difficult. You know, I think... even in high humidity, there's theories are, and it's been proven, that these dry biofilms can form just under high humidity. And as we know, in the summer, even here in Canada, the humidity in the rooms are really high, or in the atmosphere. So you certainly can mitigate that way. And you know, some people suggest, and I can agree with them, that any sort of wet sanitation shouldn't take place in low moisture food environments. And I think it makes sense, doesn't it? As we said, it doesn't dry out properly. So mitigation is one thing, but I think risk management is another, in terms of interventions to try and remove them. And that's where things get really tricky. So the thing with these dry biofilms, they can resist really high concentration of sanitizers, you know, things like bleach, neat bleach, straight out the bottle. And they're very thermally resistant. So that dry steam treatment you're using might not be effective. Now, there's two sort of things that the Achilles heel of these dormant bacteria, and that's oxidative stress and acidity. You know, they're built to last. They can live on desiccated surfaces for weeks, months, maybe years. But where they become susceptible is to oxidative damage. Now, that might be tempting to say, well, why don't we just use ozone gas then? Like, ozone everything. The problem with ozone, it only really works above 80% relative humidity. So you're kind of introducing humidity, which you don't want, and the ozone will corrode everything in these really extended times. So in our research, what we've developed is something called the hydroxy radical process, where you basically use hydrogen peroxide vapor with UV, and that breaks down to hydroxy radicals. And these hydroxy radicals are highly oxidative. So unlike ozone, for example, you would have to have at least 30-minute contact time at very high humidity. This takes about 10 seconds to do. So that's one option. Another option is propyl alcohol, but not just propyl alcohol, propyl alcohol with flavonoids in. If you just try propyl alcohol, which is the mainstay of the low-moisture food industry, it hardly does anything to these dry biofilms. So they're the two methods that have been proven successful. The ones that haven't been proven successful are things like UV light, ozone, chlorine dioxide. So you have to kind of think outside the box on these things.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm sitting here thinking about the difficulty involved, and I'm also wondering, is there any way to know how devastating these are to us, or how much illness, or I mean, do we think this is a concerning thing, or is this something that's been going on for a long time and we're just figuring it out?
You know, for the simple reason is that obviously dry biofilms, I think, are the early part of evolution. You know, when bacteria were in the sort of 4 billion years ago, they were subject to heat, dry, wet, all this kind of thing. So I think bacteria evolved to it. And we kind of have been living with it in some ways. You know, when we do our sampling, for example, and I've got an example of this one. There was a feed mill, a local one, and they would get these salmonella hits, and they would come and you would dress them. They'll say, well, yeah, we tried a few different things and we don't get any more salmonella hits. But then they started up again. And they were saying, where could it be? Where could these hits come from? And I think this is where you realize that you've got a dry biofilm problem, because if you can't trace it to, you know, faulty maintenance, lack of sanitation, and you might not even do sort of wet sanitation, but you're still getting the hits, then that tells you something's happening. And the trouble with, as you know, with dry feed mills these days, salmonella is very up there. You know, it's basically in the FSMA feed is equivalent to human feed. So you'll notice you've got a biofilm when you, I think, when you start getting positive hits and you can't trace it back. And I think the natural instinct, like this company I was working with, was to sanitize everything, literally get the water out and flush everything. That made it even worse. And when you think about the dry biofilm physiology and how it grows and distributes, that's probably why it was. So we've probably lived with it for a long time, but I think those companies and, you know, dairy companies, especially infant formula, which has been in the news recently, they're suffering from this. They say, look, we'd followed every procedure, every sanitation procedure, but what they didn't take into account was, oh, it could be dry biofilms, which are much more tolerant, much more resistant to sanitizer. So we have lived with them, but I think it's for those companies that have this persistent problem and they can't trace it back. And in those situations, what I would recommend is, you know, take samples of a surface, you know, take samples of product. And when you're doing your enrichment, you know, just add some pyruvate, add some catalase, and see if you get positives from them. Be ahead of the game. You know, it's not regulatory required, but I always say, you know, if you've got salmonella, for example, in the facility, it's going to come out sooner or later. So it's good to be ahead of the game. So that's what I recommend for sure.
Yeah, good recommendation. And like you said, it may not be regulatory today, but the more we understand about it, the more likely it will become regulatory. I've been in the feed business for 40 years. And as you mentioned, the new FSMA regulations are quite different than the Cosmetic Act of 1921 or whatever we were running under before. So it's coming, right?
Yeah, I think you find that with science, isn't it? I think, yeah. It's like when we had this sort of progress on diagnostic tests, you know, quicker, more sensitive, cheaper. And everybody started testing and saying, oh, gee, we've got problems in that. So I always think it's a good idea to have solutions before you get to the problem. So I think you're right. You know, it's going to come eventually.
Well, and so tied to that, what do you see as, you know, research gaps? What do we need to be doing to get on top of this thing and figure out how to handle it?
Well, like I say, the research gaps are massive, you know, because the reality is we've been focusing on wet biofilms for, you know, how long? Like when you say, well, there's dry biofilms as well, you know, that's to say, well, we haven't solved the wet biofilms yet. So I think what we really need to do is understand better the sort of resistance of these biofilms, what can form biofilms, how we can mitigate them. And the problem with dry biofilms is how we work with them in the lab. So when you're making a biofilm, a wet biofilm, it's easy. You just get a coupon, maybe stainless steel rubber, you put it into a culture, you leave it there for 5 days, bring it out, you've got a biofilm. And the problem with dry biofilm research at the moment is that they're kind of cheating in terms of they'll start off with a biofilm, you know, by taking a coupon, for example, and putting it into some culture for about 24 hours, but then they bring it out and leave it for 66 hours or longer to dry out and say, well, the dry biofilm, isn't it? So I think we've got a technique where, you know, we basically try to mimic the industry in terms of, yes, you'll get humidity rather than this sort of overwhelming culture. So once we've got a model where we can form these biofilms and we can cross-check them with what we find in industry, that's where we can start mitigating practices, you know, making interventions like the hydroxy radical process where we can address them. But my belief is that when people start looking at closely at them, they'll be finding more and more. You know, as I mentioned to you, as the science goes with VBNC cells, where they're starting to be able to resuscitate them, I wouldn't be surprised if it'll be common practice saying, yeah, we'll put these resuscitating agents in just to bring the salmonella out. And then the argument say, well, are they a risk? Like, we can, you know, get sensitive detection of salmonella, VBNC, but how does that translate to people getting ill? So that's the other neat research gap as well. Saying, okay, we can see these dry biofilms and we can recover them, but ultimately, does that lead to something down the road, or do they simply just go back to sleep again? So the research gaps are definitely there. It's going to be very interesting to see how it develops over time.
Well, that kind of exhausts the questions I have for you. Is there anything that we've missed or that you'd like to bring up that we haven't covered?
No, I think, like I say, it's one of these emerging areas that, you know, started off in the healthcare sector, and like most things, it kind of trickles down to the food industry. And in a lot of ways, I can see these dry biofilms as maybe the main problem, even though wet biofilms are. So it'll be interesting to see how it develops. And like I mentioned, I think if you're in industry and you're seeing these persistent problems, you have maybe salmonella in the feed and you just can't get rid of it, maybe look at the dry biofilm just to check to see if it's that could be the issue.
Well, thank you very much to all of you watching. I hope you've found this as interesting as I have. If you like it, give us a like. If you want to share it with someone that you think would find it interesting, we'd appreciate it. And obviously subscribe to our channel, that we'd appreciate that. And so for today, I'm going to thank Dr. Warner for all his information and for taking the time to share with us. And goodbye and God bless you.
Thanks, Bob.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.